This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm Sean Lay. Robert F. Kennedy is a major figure in US politics, a member of perhaps the most famous political dynasty of the last century, the nephew and son of assassinated political leaders and himself a former independent candidate for president. Mr. Kennedy is also a highly contested choice for Health and Human Services Secretary in Donald Trump's cabinet. An environmental lawyer by experience, he spent decades as a vocal critic of existing health practice. He's made baseless health claims in the past, including that vaccines cause autism or can cause autism. His views have not endeared him to members of his wider family. On Tuesday, his cousin Caroline, daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, wrote a letter to senators setting out why she thought he shouldn't be confirmed. Here she is reading out the conclusion. She's talking about people who work in America's healthcare system.
They deserve a knowledgeable leader who is committed to evidence and excellence. They deserve a secretary committed to advancing cutting-edge medicine to save lives, not to rejecting the advances we have already made. They deserve a stable, moral, and ethical person at the helm of this crucial agency. They deserve better than Bobby Kennedy, and so do the rest of us. I urge the Senate to reject his nomination.
Well, today, with members of his immediate family sitting behind him, Robert F. Kennedy faced a Senate nomination hearing, knowing senators have the final say on whether or not he gets confirmed. This is from his opening statement, including a brief interruption from the public gallery. In it, Mr. Kennedy declared, no, he was not opposed to vaccination, one of the charges most frequently levelled against him.
News reports have claimed that I'm anti-vaccine or anti-industry. I am neither. I am pro-safety.
We'll have order. Please proceed, Mr. Kennedy.
I am pro-safety. I worked for years to raise awareness about the mercury and toxic chemicals in fish, and nobody called me any fish. And I believe that that vaccines play a critical role in healthcare. All of my kids are vaccinated. I've written many books on vaccines. My first book in 2014, the first line of it is I am not anti-vaccine, and the last line is I am not anti-vaccine.
Well, in often heated exchanges with the opposition Democrats, the party to which he used to belong, he faced challenges like this one from Senator Elizabeth Warren. She asked about an allegation that Mr. Kennedy profits from working with a company which recruits people to sue vaccine makers.
I'm asking you to commit right now that you will not take a financial stake in every one of those lawsuits so that what you do as secretary will also benefit you financially down the line.
I'll comply with all the ethical guidelines.
That's not the question. You and I, you have said
you're asking me not to sue pharmaceutical companies.
No, I am not.
That's exactly what you're doing.
No. Look, no one should be fooled here.
As Secretary of HHS,
Robert Kennedy will have the power to undercut vaccines and vaccine manufacturing across our country. And for all of his talk about follow the science and his promise that he won't interfere with those of us who want to vaccinate his kids, the bottom line is the same. Kennedy can kill off access to vaccines and make millions of dollars while he does it. Kids might die, but Robert Kennedy can keep cashing in.
Senator, I support vaccines. I support the childhood schedule. I will do that. The only thing I want is good science.
Robert Kennedy was being questioned there by Senator Elizabeth Warren, but he also had supporters in the hearing. Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, addressed the nominee with enthusiasm.
I don't know if you remember when you called me up and you were contemplating setting your political differences aside, joining forces with President Trump on an area of agreement, addressing chronic illness, trying to find the root cause of all these problems facing this nation. My first response was, Bobby, this is an answer to my prayers. We need to get to the answers of this, but even more, we need to heal and unify this divided nation. I'm not necessarily the most optimistic guy because we've got enormous challenges facing this nation. But I thought, wow, here's somebody from the left, somebody I don't agree with on many issues politically, coming together with President Trump and focusing on an area of agreement, something that the American people desperately want. Finding out the answers. What has caused autism? What is causing chronic illness?
Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Well, our Washington correspondent Nomia Iqbal watched the proceedings, asked what she'd made of them.
Well, they were pretty spicy, aggressive, pretty bruising for RFK as well. But I think it was always going to be that way. I mean, there are many people that Donald Trump has picked to be in his cabinet. They've all provoked controversy in some way or the other, but no one has quite done that like RFK, as he's known. He's been criticised by scientists and doctors for his anti-vaccine positions, although in the hearing he said he wasn't anti-vaccine, he was pro-vaccine. That prompted some protesters to shout out, "You lie," and they were taken out. A lot of the Democratic senators didn't buy his position on that. They pointed to interviews that he's done on various shows and podcasts in which he has repeated his debunked claims about vaccines causing autism, for example. He's also been questioned about his position on abortion by conservatives. I mean, they don't quite believe him. They're pretty suspicious. He was pro-abortion, and then the next minute he's not in favour of abortion to a certain period, and then he's saying he's aligning with Trump. So there was a lot of back and forth, and there will be a second hearing tomorrow. He'll face another committee, and then both committees will vote and decide whether to take it to the full Senate for a vote.
Now, that obviously is the stage that he could therefore get confirmed if the committees don't want to refer it to the full Senate. It kind of goes through. What are the prospects, though, of it going to the full Senate? I mean, was there any sign, for example, of any Republican unease in the questioning so far today?
Well, that's why I was keeping an eye on, and I think everyone was, because ultimately, if all Democrats go against him, he could only afford to lose three Republicans. Mm. Bill Cassidy was an interesting one. He is a Republican, and he's also a doctor, and he has expressed scepticism about RFK and his position on vaccines, and he's always been pretty frosty when you ask him, you know, how did his meetings with RFK go?
The BBC's Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Well, Dr. Tom Frieden was director of the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, during the Obama administration, a national public health agency. It's one of the bodies which Mr. Kennedy would be responsible for if he's confirmed as health secretary. Dr. Frieden is now the CEO of the not-for-profit organization Resolve to Save Lives. So what did he make of Robert F. Kennedy's appearance?
Well, Mr. Kennedy raises a number of issues, but I think he's got a very heavy baggage in what he's been doing for many years in disseminating misinformation about vaccines. In fact, he is one of the top 10 misinformation sources on vaccines. So
it's not, from your point of view, it's not enough for him to say, "I am anti-vaccine," because of what he said before. I mean, is there a way he could overcome that doubt among practitioners like yourself?
Well, it's hard because he has repeatedly said things that aren't true and then repeatedly denied saying things that he's on tape as having said. So it's very hard to believe him when he says, "I'm not going to interfere with your children's vaccines," because there are lots of ways he could do that. He talks about conflicts of interest, and this is one of the areas in which I think it's important to get the facts straight. It is very important that we get conflicts of interest out of medical decision making, but Mr. Kennedy pointedly refused to not make a profit from suing pharmaceutical manufacturers.
I mean, there is
it's
an argument,
to
isn't
sue
there?
And win.
Sorry to interrupt. There is an argument, isn't there? There's quite a lot of America's political leadership, both on Democrat and Republican side, is beholden because of finance contributions to those who make money out of health, and that therefore that in a sense is not so much criticism of him individually, it's in a sense criticism of the whole way things are structured in the United States at the moment.
It's absolutely true that there's too much money determining what public policy is rather than looking at what the facts show. One of the areas that's been very clear on insulating from influences is the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP. They have extremely stringent rules. And I know because I oversaw that committee when I was CDC director for 8 years. People came from all over the world to see it as a model, a gold standard of good vaccine policy setting, openly transparent, every contact with industry disclosed openly, every deliberation open. And today, Mr. Kennedy tried to say that that body is terribly conflicted and okay. He just wants the science. Well, his view of the science is very jaundiced, frankly.
There was a bit of confusion over Medicare and Medicaid programs that cover more than 150 million Americans between them. That might be of concern, I guess, both to Republican and Democrat senators.
It is, but the perhaps the more interesting issue is his raising the issue of chronic disease.
Yes.
And chronic disease is a huge problem for Americans, and it's not a mystery. The causes of chronic disease are tobacco, sugary and salty food, alcohol, and there are some things that we know that can make a difference with that.
And he did receive quite loud applause, didn't he, when he promised to make America healthy again. I mean, this is an area where, is it possible this will help his efforts to get confirmed? Because he seems to have kind of hit a nerve for many Americans, anxious about what goes into the food they eat.
I think he is tapping into a great deal of public concern and a real issue. We have increases in obesity. We have a falling life expectancy. The main causes of that are not mysterious. And there are government things that can be done to, for example, make sodas relatively more expensive and fruit and vegetables less expensive, to tax tobacco and alcohol, to empower consumers by saying what's unhealthy.
And might he actually be the man to push that through, because he doesn't have the background that some other politicians have in terms of links with the industry?
To be very blunt, those are positions that are very unlikely to get a majority of the current Congress behind, and that he cannot really do many of as HHS secretary.
Where you sit now, do you think it's likely that he will get confirmed?
I think we'll have to see how the rest of the hearings go. Today was just the first day of them. I think it's clear that he is potentially a major risk to vaccine uptake and to the safety of kids in the U.S. He's got some other interesting views, which, if he were to get confirmed, would possibly raise some openings for healthy policies. But, vaccines are one of the greatest advances that humanity has made. They prevented millions of deaths from COVID, and he tried to stop the COVID vaccination. So I'd be very concerned.
That's Dr. Tom Frieden reflecting on Robert F. Kennedy's nomination hearing before the US Senate. Mr. Kennedy, who Donald Trump wants to be health secretary, will face more questions tomorrow. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up, as Belarus's veteran president is re-elected unopposed, we hear from the country's exiled opposition leader, who says she's still convinced democratic change will eventually come.
I truly believe. How long it will take, I don't know, but it's very important that this shift that took place in 2020, it will not disappear.
The headlines here on NewsHour. Rwanda-backed M23 rebels are reported to be continuing their advance after capturing the key city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Donald Trump's announced plans to turn the notorious Guantanamo Bay military prison into a detention facility for tens of thousands of undocumented migrants. And researchers say samples taken from the asteroid Bennu contained the building blocks of DNA, shedding new light on how the ingredients for life on Earth may have arrived here. More on that story later here on NewsHour. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC. As Israel prepares to outlaw from tomorrow the UN Relief and Works Agency known as UNRWA, there are fresh warnings that it could undermine critical aid delivery in Gaza. Israeli officials have yet to spell out how the new law will be enforced there and in the occupied West Bank. UNRWA supports some 6 million Palestinians spread across the Middle East. Israel's already ordered it to close its schools and clinics, serving tens of thousands of people in Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolanda Nell, sent us this report.
Vast crowds of displaced people in Gaza on the move this week. returning to the north. Most remain homeless. But even before this war, the majority of Gazans were classed as refugees, cared for by the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA. Now spokeswoman Julia Tuma says it's under threat.
It would be a catastrophe. If this ban comes into place, what it will mean is that it will deepen and further the suffering of the Palestinian people who rely on the agency for their survival, for the education of their children, for their healthcare.
Recently, the Nasir family has been living in an UNRWA school turned shelter in central Gaza. As the descendants of Palestinians forced from their land when Israel was created in 1948, they've always had UNRWA food aid. Now they fear losing it, and 16-year-old Malak worries she won't be able to go back to school.
Everyone in Gaza has a specific dream and a bright future if they learn. If you ask any child what they want to be when they grow up, they'll say a doctor or an engineer. If education is stopped, then there will be no dreams for Gazan children.
Israel has long criticized UNRWA schools, saying they promote the idea of Palestinians returning to their historic homes. But tensions have risen since the 7th of October attacks. A UN investigation found that 9 UNRWA workers, out of some 13,000 employed in Gaza, may have joined the deadly assault and fired them. The agency insists it's impartial, but Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister Sharon Haskell claims it's a security threat.
Israel actually gave more than a year to the international community to clean out this organization from the infiltration of Hamas, but it didn't. So after a year, this was the only step, the logic step that we could do in making sure that this organization will not harm Israeli citizens.
Some UNRWA operations have already closed in Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem, where there are tens of thousands of Palestinian refugees. This is the narrow main street of Shuafat camp. It's bustling with people. Refugee camps like this one, UNRWA itself, were never supposed to be permanent. What happens to refugees was meant to be worked out in peace talks, but they stalled long ago. Now, many Palestinians here feel Israel's using this opportunity to push its own solution.
As you see on the front of us is the Shuafat Camp Health Center, which is run by UNRWA. And on the other side are the schools.
Retired local doctor Salim Anati tells me people here reject the Israeli change.
All people are shocked because it's something fundamental for us as refugees. And UNRWA represent the international law and international agreements of our dream of right to return back to our homeland.
The new laws prohibit Israeli officials from any contact with UNRWA, but there's uncertainty over exactly how they'll work. Top UN figures worry that they're coming into force just as a fragile ceasefire is taking hold in Gaza, and warn they could also have an impact on the long-term chances of peace.
Yolan Nell reporting. It's been called primordial soup, the mix of chemicals from which life on Earth emerged. The catalyst for life itself appears to have been the impact of an asteroid striking our planet. But did the asteroid bring the building blocks with it? Scientists say they now know something more about the process, that the chemicals involved in creating life here may exist elsewhere. To explain, NewsHour turned to Professor Sarah Russell, who's a cosmic mineralogist at London's Natural History Museum, co-lead author of an article just published in Nature. Professor Russell told me about the asteroid they collected samples from and what those samples revealed.
So we learned quite a lot about the sample from when we were looking at it from space. So we were expecting it to have water and carbon in it, and it turned out it did have those things. But the thing that surprised us was that it also contained this series of salts. So it contained sodium chloride, which is table salt, and also a series of carbonates and sulfates and phosphates. And we didn't expect that at all because we didn't see them from our analyses from space. And that's because they were present only in very small amounts. So we had to have the sample on Earth to be able to look at it with this kind of fine tooth comb to find these.
And having looked at it on Earth, what conclusions have you reached?
Yeah, so these salts have told us an awful lot about the history of the asteroid. So what we think is that it probably formed in the outermost part of the solar system, and it formed from a mixture of rock and ice. Then it warmed up slightly enough for the ice to melt. And then the ice reacted with the rocky bits to form a clay mineral, which makes up the most of the asteroid. But then there were pockets of water left behind, and these were like a salty, briny, kind of brackish room temperature, tepid salt water. And then the final salts were formed when this water evaporated.
And these, some of these minerals would have been present in the development of life on Earth?
Yeah, so one of the reasons we were kind of interested to find this evidence of this briny fluid is because this is a great place to create new organic molecules. So we found amino acids and nucleotides as well. So we found these kind of building blocks for life. And we think that the brines kind of played a part in creating these organic molecules. And the salts themselves are full of elements that are needed for life, like phosphorus and sulfur. And we know that asteroids like Bennu probably hit the early Earth and other planets as well, like Mars, in the earliest times in the solar system. And they might have brought all these ingredients, both the organic stuff and the water and the phosphorus and the sulfur as well, in this whole package of stuff that was brought to the Earth that could have then kickstarted life. So we think that it, yeah, would have delivered all of these building blocks, and yeah, maybe not just on Earth. So Mars would have been impacted too, and other places around the solar system may have had this kind of seeding of all of these ingredients needed for life.
You talk about seeding, it's a lovely word. It captures the idea that somehow the process was a process of bringing something to the Earth rather than something just naturally occurring here.
Yeah, well, in the earliest times of Earth's history, it would have become very, very hot, which means that it would have lost all of its water and all of its carbon. So then it actually needed to have these asteroids to bring back these materials that it might have lost in its early history.
So in other words, the potential exists, at least, that that process could have happened elsewhere in the universe too.
Yeah, so not just in our solar system, but maybe on planets around other stars as well.
That's Professor Sarah Russell from London's Natural History Museum talking to me here on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC with me, Sean Lay. The Rwanda-backed rebel group M23 has strengthened its hold on the city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And tonight there are eyewitness accounts that they have advanced south towards the city of Bukavu, despite international calls for them to withdraw. The US State Department has ordered non-emergency staff into that. I am sorry, that's the wrong item I'm reading you there. We're going to come to that a little later. One of Europe's longest-serving leaders, Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus, has been declared the winner of the weekend's presidential election with 87% of the vote. His Russian ally President Putin called it a convincing victory. As our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford now reports, the opposition appears more depressed than defiant.
In 2020, this was the sound of defiance in Belarus. The free choir sang on the streets as crowds flooded out, protesting against an election rigged to keep Alexander Lukashenko in power. The choir are now in exile. But even here in Poland, they perform with red and white masks covering their faces. Because the security forces back home have warned that anyone supporting the opposition, even abroad, can be prosecuted. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya doesn't hide her face. She had to flee Belarus too in 2020, after running for president against Lukashenko and claiming a win. Then came the protests, the police brutality, and the mass arrests. This election was very different.
No independent candidates, no observers, no free media, all real opponents either in prison or in exile, so it's sham.
Do you still feel now that there is a chance of democratic change? Yes. How confident do you feel that that moment will actually come?
I truly believe it was a huge shift in mentality of Belarusians. How long it will take, I don't know, but it's very important that this shift that took place in 2020, it will not disappear.
But it's hard to keep that conviction alive. That's what this entire event in Warsaw was about. Because 4 years after they tried and failed to topple a dictator, the Belarusians I've been speaking to are struggling. Яна is a vet, just out of prison after serving 3 years for joining the peaceful protests. She calculates that 1 in 10 of the inmates in her prison were there for their politics.
It was only when I could sleep again that I realized how emotionally and physically hard it had been.
Poland is now home to huge numbers of Belarusians, driven out not by war, but by fear of interrogation, intimidation and arrest.
Sarah Rainsford reporting for NewsHour on the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC with me, Sean Lay. Now, the Rwanda-backed rebel group M23 has strengthened its hold on the city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And tonight, there are eyewitness accounts that they have advanced south towards the city of Bukavu, despite international calls for them to withdraw. The US State Department has ordered its non-emergency staff to leave the country immediately. In a moment, we'll be asking what leverage can be applied by those outside the region on the M23 and its backers to try to halt the fighting. First, though, to the deputy head of the UN Stabilisation Mission in the DRC, Vivian van de Pere. She's in Goma. NewsHour's James Menendez asked her if she can confirm that the M23 rebel group is now in charge there.
They control the city. They have roadblocks everywhere, but there are pockets of resistance and fighting, and there's many elements still roaming. So I wouldn't call it complete control, but they definitely have established themselves in Goma.
And what about the airport? Is that in M23 hands too, do you know?
It is my understanding that the airport is in M23 hands right now, but I have not been able to go there, so I have not independently verified that. But from the troops that we have around the airport, the M23 seems to be controlling the airport.
And if that is the case, what are the implications for delivery of humanitarian aid in the days to come?
That is a big hindrance, indeed. So we need the airport to be reopened as soon as possible by whoever controls it, so that we can establish air bridges with the outside world in order to get humanitarian aid that is desperately needed into this region.
Well, I was going to ask you, how bad is the situation? What do people need right now?
They need absolutely everything. First of all, they need safety and security. We've had a couple of days of heavy fighting between M23 and the government and its allies. Fortunately, that has largely calmed down now. But the M23, as I understand it, is trying to establish themselves here as the, if I can call it, de facto authorities. And they would be, since they are in control at the moment, and it's just a reality, they would be responsible for re-establishing safety and security. Secondly, humanitarian needs are tremendous. The population is suffering tremendously. They need food, water, medical care, everything. The electricity has been down. The Wi-Fi has been down. Water is in very short supply. Even our own troops in MINUSCO, we are running low on supplies, and some bases have run out because many of the population have been coming to seek refuge in our bases, including, by the way, surrendering armed elements that have entered our bases without weapons, of course.
I'm sorry, on that, do you mean Congolese troops are sheltering in UN bases?
Yeah, it's sometimes hard to tell because they also had a lot of allies. So there's also various armed elements that cannot be clearly identified because we allow people on our base only if they're disarmed, no arms allowed, and also no uniforms. So it's kind of hard to tell, but one can assume that there's large numbers of the Congolese coalition among them.
Have you had any direct contact yourself with the rebels?
Necessarily, we need to coordinate on certain very urgent issues, such as our freedom of movement. We are doing our utmost to play a role in the protection of civilians. So yes, I have coordinated with them on our freedom of movement, and we are trying to establish some kind of working relationship right now. They claim that they want the best for the population. So if I take them on their word, then I am going to use that to make sure that MONUSCO is allowed to go out and to help the population where it can.
So the UN troops, are they at the moment just confined to barracks, if you like, or are they able to go out at all?
They have now starting to get around since this morning, and that's the result of the technical coordination that I talked to you about. We are able to get around, which was extremely urgent because some of our bases had run out of food and water and are literally sheltering thousands of people. So they have allowed us, if I can use that word, it's a loaded word, but they have allowed us to go and resupply those bases so that we can take care of all the people that find themselves in there.
Is it possible, though, that the rebels and their Rwandan backers don't just want Goma, that they want to move on to elsewhere in the country, even head to Kinshasa? I mean, the Rebel Alliance is led by a man who said, our objective is Kinshasa, the source of all the problems. Is this a sort of local conflict that's going to explode into something much, much bigger?
Well, that is the fear that everybody has. We cannot predict how this will go. The M23 itself seems to have more a localized objective, but they're backed by their political allies, the Alliance Fleuve Congo, and they have stated this goal. At this moment, it's impossible to predict what the next steps will be, but that would be the worst case scenario.
That was Vivian van de Perre, deputy head of the UN mission MINUSCO, talking to James Menendez. More than a decade ago, in September 2012, during a previous surge in the crisis, the European Union suspended aid to Rwanda following allegations, which Rwanda denied, that it was backing rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo, its neighbour. That decision has been credited with easing the crisis. Belgium is still one of the European countries which provides aid to Rwanda. Bernard Quentin is its foreign minister, and earlier I asked him about the chances of aid being suspended once again. First, though, we talked about what responsibility he thinks Rwanda has for this latest crisis.
Well, the responsibility of Rwanda in the situation in the eastern part of the Congo is not only a breach in the ceasefire, it's also an important breach against the international law. They have around 4,000 RDF in the country. It's not me saying it, it's a UN report.
RDF and, being the Rwandan Defense Forces.
Rwandan Defense Forces, exactly. So that is in breach. And on top of that, with the seize of Goma, it's also a breach of the ceasefire. So, and it makes the Luanda processes even more difficult, the political process, for the ceasefire.
The Rwandan government has responded by accusing Belgium of bias, pointing to what it called your deafening silence and inaction in the face of bellicose speeches against Rwanda by Congo's president. How do you respond to that?
We are not biased. When we defend international law and international humanitarian law, I think it's strange to be accused of bias. It's all the international law. That's the first thing. The second thing, it is just untrue that we did not denounce the hate speeches. We did it publicly, and we did it in all the contacts that we have with the Congolese authorities. And once again, we did it publicly also via communique. So it is not true to tell that we didn't do that. We also urges the Congolese authority to stop any association with the FDLR. I mean, you can find that back in the communique of my ministry.
The Belgium embassy in DRC was attacked. That's in Kinshasa, of course, which is a huge distance from the front line of the fighting. What can you tell us about the situation there?
The situation is calmer tonight, but it's a huge distance between Goma and Kinshasa. It's true, but it's one country.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what happened in Kinshasa is due to the situation in Goma. It doesn't excuse the violence against the embassy. I called myself the prime minister, and she sent immediately policemen to restore order. So an attack against an embassy is totally unacceptable under Vienna Convention. An attack on goods properties, it's totally unacceptable. So we protested a lot, and we called the authorities to restore order in the city. Today, the protests were forbidden and didn't happen. There is a call for other protests, so we are not against protest. I mean, this is part of freedom, but they have to be peaceful.
The European Union countries and other international donors contributed an enormous amount of money to that part of Africa. The EU, for example, helps fund the Rwandan army, with, I think most recently, $20 million through the EU Peace Facility, which is supposed to deal with the domestic insurgency. Back in 2012, the EU and others suspended aid, and it appeared to persuade Rwanda to call off the M23 group and other members at that stage. What can you do now? Could you do the same again?
But actually, you mentioned the situation in 2012, and it's exactly that. We took measures, and the measures were enough to put pressure on the Rwanda and the rebels to get out of Goma and to enter in a political and disarmament process. I called my colleagues of the European Union during the Foreign Affairs Council meeting on Monday to examine the possibilities that we have in our system. The ambassador had meeting yesterday and maybe today too, to see the whole range of our cooperation with Rwanda and to see if we can take measure exactly like we did more than 10 years ago to put pressure and just to say withdraw from Goma for the rebels. They have to go back to Rwanda.
Might it now be too late to repeat that, given how much of eastern Congo and how much of Goma itself appears already to be in the rebel hands?
It's never too late to try to reach peace, because we have to also acknowledge that we speak of 30 years of problems in the region, of wars, and I'm not saying that it's all the fault of Rwanda. That's not what I'm saying. But it's the huge suffering of millions of people. Displaced refugees and so on. That is the main question for us, is how we help to bring peace for those people.
The aid you're talking about is with the EU. Would Belgium consider cutting its own bilateral aid with Rwanda?
I will be very frank with you. We prefer to have an EU response. Not that we are not ready to do it bilaterally, but if we want to have an impact on the ground, it's better to make it at the EU level. Let's see what we can do at the EU level. We have a few days now to have the discussion. I hope that by the end of the week we will have more clarity. And then I will speak with my colleagues of the Belgian government to see if we have to do something more at the bilateral level. It's not the question for today. It's maybe the question for tomorrow. The question for today is to see what we can and will do at the European level.
That's Belgium's Foreign Minister Bernard Quintin. To India now, where at least 30 people attending the Kumbh Mela, the world's largest religious gathering, were killed in a stampede that happened before dawn on Wednesday. The event, held every 12 years, attracts millions of people wanting to take part in its rituals. Deadly searches have happened before. Our correspondent Samira Hussain reports from there.
The aftermath was chaotic. Emergency workers were frantically moving the dead. Bodies could be seen among the piles of people's personal belongings, shoes, shirts, and blankets left strewn along the riverbank. Ram Tripathi Tiwari found himself trapped in the throng with his sisters.
The crowds were pushing and shoving. We were holding hands, trying to save our lives. In that crush, my sister fell and died. Her body was taken to hospital. My other sister is lost, and we don't know where she is.
The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, said what had happened was extremely sad, and he offered his condolences to the relatives of those killed. It took the government more than 12 hours before it released an official number of dead and injured, which is highly unusual. A move widely seen as an attempt by authorities to downplay what has happened.
That's Samira Hussain reporting from northern India. And this is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. A reminder of our top story on NewsHour. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., whose scepticism about vaccines has raised alarm among health experts, is facing his first test in the Senate as he seeks to become America's top health official. Tom Frieden, former director of America's National Public Health Agency, the Centers for Disease Control, told NewsHour he thought Mr. Kennedy, if appointed, could be a risk to vaccine uptake.
He's got some other interesting views, which, if he were to get confirmed, would possibly raise some openings for healthy policies. But, you know, vaccines are one of the greatest advances that humanity has made. They prevented millions of deaths from COVID, and he tried to stop the COVID vaccination. So I'd be very concerned.
One further headline, Rwanda-backed M23 rebels are reported to be continuing to advance after capturing the key city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. They call it Germany's firewall, the refusal of Germany's big political parties to cooperate with the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD. Well, it's taken something of a hit on Wednesday after a motion narrowly passed in the Bundestag, the federal parliament, with the backing of the AfD. This comes just weeks ahead of February's election. The man widely tipped to be the nation's next chancellor, Friedrich Merz of the conservative CDU, had tabled a call for tougher border and asylum rules. That prompted the incumbent chancellor, Olaf Scholz, a Social Democrat, to accuse him of an unforgivable mistake. Jürgen Hart is an MP with the CDU. He voted for the proposals today.
This is our policy. We are on a campaign trail. People should see what we want to do concrete against the situation in Germany concerning the refugees.
Well, I've been speaking to our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker. She told me how significant this vote was.
So in a way, it sounds not so important, but actually it's incredibly important, and it's sending shockwaves here in Germany because it is being seen as a breach of what you just mentioned, Sean, this term firewall, which I guess to some people in its strictest sense means not going into coalition with the far right, which is not what has happened tonight. What has happened tonight is that Friedrich Merz, leading the CDU, running right up to an election, has chosen, even though he says he's sort of done it reluctantly, to push through this call for tougher border rules with votes from Alternative für Deutschland. And he's going to table actual legislation on Friday. So there's the possibility that he could lean on those votes again to actually try and push through legislation, although the election's so near, I think many people regard that as highly unlikely that it could go through. But I think number one significant is this crack in the firewall. He's under a huge amount of criticism for it. The AfD, who consider the firewall as completely undemocratic, are celebrating. They feel they have even more momentum now. They're already polling second in the polls. And I think as well, Friedrich Merz tonight, some people are saying he will have lost trust with possible coalition partners moving forward, because he said he won't go into coalition with the AfD. So then you're looking at the Green Party or the Social Democrats, and they are putting big question marks over his name tonight after this move that he has made.
In neighbouring Austria, we had the centre-right there revoking a similar commitment not to work with the far-right Freedom Party. Mm. Although I suppose the difference is the Freedom Party had previously been in government before, which the AfD in Germany definitely hasn't. Are there signs that people in some in the CDU, Mr. Merz's party, might actually think it's time to change his never to a maybe?
I mean, I think there's discomfort in the CDU actually about what Mr. Merz is doing. Some support it, as you were just playing there. I think the likelihood of the firewall, or the cordon sanitaire, to give it its sort of French name, breaking at this election it is not regarded as at all likely, not at all likely. Some, I think, would say just isn't going to happen. What the AFD is saying, though, is that they believe, and you could say, well, they would say this, wouldn't they? But they believe that over the coming years, they will chip away at this firewall. And I think what we'll call nervousness tonight for people who strongly oppose the AFD is this the first step in that direction? And now, of course, at this stage, we really don't know. We don't even know who's going to win the election. But Friedrich Merz has consistently been polling highest in terms of the CDU party, not him personally, but his party has been polling top. So there's the question of who will go into coalition with. As I say, he's ruled out going into coalition with the AFD, but his actions tonight, I think, are really huge news here in Germany, because it's something that just hasn't been done before, and he's gone there.
Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker, and the federal election takes place on the 23rd of February. DeepSeek, the AI chatbot developed in China, has already sent a shiver down the spine of investors in US artificial intelligence this week. Its development costs, for one, are much lower. Now, OpenAI, which developed one of the earliest search tools, ChatGPT, has accused the Chinese of stealing its intellectual property. So what effect is this intensifying US-China rivalry having? Well, I've been speaking to Angela Zhang, Professor of Law at the Gould School of Law, University of Southern California, author of High Wire, How China Regulates Big Tech and Governs Its Economy. I asked her first to explain what OpenAI meant when it accused DeepSeek of using something called distillation to build its model.
Basically, they are accusing the Chinese firms of using a lot of the AI generative output to train their own models. And this is actually quite a common industry practice. And a lot of people in the community have been doing that, especially when they train smaller models. But I guess OpenAI was quite upset because DeepSeek was able to use this technique to generate very powerful model with very comparable capability.
You might argue that's what competition is all about. And clearly there's been an acceleration of announcements, hasn't there? I think Alibaba in China today announced a new large AI model to compete with OpenAI. But what are the potential risks of companies maybe rushing to market before they quite know what they've got?
Yeah, this has always been a deep concern for the AI safety community. And now with, you know, the emergence of DeepSeek and the proliferation of, you know, very powerful AI models, open source or closed source from China, I think there will be greater push for the US companies, right? As Trump has said that, you know, this is a wake up call for us that we need to do better, right? I mean, so that's precisely why, you know, there could be more AI safety concern, because it seems like, you know, countries like China and the United States are kind of like in a race to the bottom when it comes to AI safety, why so much emphasis is on, you know, claiming AI supremacy, you know.
And presumably a challenge for regulators to keep up with the process and the speed with which it's accelerating.
Yes, it's going to be really hard. And recently, a lot of the leading AI experts have released an AI safety report and urging the international community to do more with AI safety. But I think this is not the focal point of the discussion at the moment.
That's Professor Angela Zhang from the University of Southern California talking to me, Sean Lay, here on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And thank you for listening. Do join us again.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space.
after the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.